Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We have a lot to get to, including the latest from General Motors and Michigan State University. But we start with the lame duck session at the Capitol. This week, the Republican-controlled State House and Senate have passed hundreds of bills affecting everything from access to abortion medicine to pushing back the start of a $12 minimum wage to 2030. They've also proposed big changes to the legalization of marijuana measure just approved by Michigan voters in November. For more on that, we're joined by MLive's Amy Biocchini. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
First, I understand this proposal would take aim at the potential revenue that could be generated by the legalization of marijuana.
Yes, the bill would significantly cut the excise tax rate on marijuana from 10% to 3%. And it would also change what the revenue from the tax funds. Under Proposal 1, millions of dollars in marijuana tax revenue was supposed to go to Michigan roads, school districts, and communities with retail marijuana stores. So this bill would change that, making recreational marijuana taxes more similar to the medical marijuana tax, which funds communities with marijuana facilities, county sheriffs, and state police.
The law that voters passed allows adults to grow up to 12 marijuana plants for personal consumption. How would the proposal change that?
It would change it significantly by eliminating the ability for people to grow marijuana at home entirely. It also cut out a special microgrower's license that would have allowed people to grow up to 150 plants with that license, something that was compared to the craft brewery industry in Michigan.
Which lawmakers behind this proposal and why do they want changes?
Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff proposed the bill Thursday. He'll be leaving the Senate at the end of this session. He previously tried and failed to pass his own marijuana legalization bill during the summer when Republican lawmakers were trying to control the language around marijuana legalization through an adopt and amend plan, but they failed to act in time and the measure went to the voters to decide. Meekhoff has previously expressed concerns about the ability of people to grow marijuana at home and what it would mean for neighborhoods.
For Senator Meekhoff to be successful in making these changes, how many votes does he have to have?
He'll need a three-quarters majority of both the House and the Senate, which is many more votes than a simple majority required on any other bill. It would be difficult to come by that number of votes, especially in the House. He was unable to do it this summer. And this is lame duck, though, so anything is possible.
We've been talking to MLive's Amy Biocchini about a proposal to change the recently voter-approved legalization of marijuana in Michigan. Thank you, Amy, for joining us.
Thank you.
And we've linked to Amy's article on MLive to WKAR.org. Now to Michigan State University and two big developments from the fallout from the Larry Nassar scandal. He is the now imprisoned doctor who sexually assaulted hundreds of women and minors he was supposed to be treating. On Monday, former Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon was arraigned in Eaton County on two felony and two misdemeanor counts. Simon is charged with lying to investigators about when she knew about Nassar's crimes. WKAR's Kevin Lavery reports.
Court documents show Luana Simon met with Michigan State Police detectives last May as part of the state's probe into the Nassar case. Simon told investigators she knew a sports medicine doctor had been under review in 2014, but said she did not know who it was until 2016. The state says it can prove that Simon lied about not knowing Larry Nassar's identity. Simon's lawyers say she'll fight the charges. Attorney Lee Silver says her arrest and fingerprinting process were unnecessary.
Dr. Simon is about as far from a criminal as anybody that I could think of, and it's ridiculous, in my opinion, that she is being treated like a common criminal.
Investigators say Simon met with a senior advisor in May 2014 about Nassar. In a written affidavit, an MSP detective claims Nassar's name was handwritten on a folder the advisor brought to that meeting. But Simon's co-counsel, Mayor Morgenroth, disputes the validity of that evidence. There were no Nassar survivors present at the arraignment, but one survivor's mother was there. After the hearing, Valerie Von Frank read two prepared statements. The first was from Amanda Smith.
Hopefully, today's outcome shows every enabler that you are next. You may not have put your hands on a child, but you didn't stop Nassar from doing exactly that. That will not be tolerated any longer.
The second statement was from Von Frank's own daughter, Grace French.
My hope is that all enablers in this case are held accountable. This is a good first step, but I'm sure there are still more who knew much of what was being done to little girls in their community every day. Take this as a call to action for any other enablers. Report what you know and step up to protect your community.
Simon was released on a personal recognizance bond. She'll return to court December 18th for a preliminary examination. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And now our second MSU story this week. Do not expect town halls or open interviews with the candidates for the university's next president. In a campus-wide email on Wednesday, MSU trustees and presidential search co-chairs Diane Byram and Melanie Foster said the selection of the next MSU president will be confidential to ensure the strongest pool of candidates. That prompted this response from Natalie Rogers of Reclaim MSU, a student and faculty group that has pushed for more transparency at the university.
The next president should be someone who is a demonstrated leader that's committed to the community, and it shouldn't be about finding the most credentialed candidate through a closed search process. It should be about finding the candidate that's willing to be open and that's willing to engage with the community. So we believe that this kind of process won't yield the results that the community needs the most right now.
When the Board of Trustees is ready to vote on a new president, it will not include George Perlis. He resigned this past week. Scott Pohl explains why.
The resignation comes more than 2 months after news broke of a lawsuit alleging Perlis covered up a rape allegation involving a university field hockey player and former sports doctor Larry Nassar in 1992. Perlis was MSU athletics director that year. Perlis's term as a trustee runs through 2022. Trustee Diane Byram says the timing surprised her.
I was surprised that it came at the end of the year and not the beginning of the year if he was considering resignation.
According to an MSU press release, Governor Rick Snyder's office has been notified of the resignation. The governor will make an appointment in the near future. Byram says she's sure that his health and not the Nassar-related allegation against him prompted Perlis to resign. In East Lansing, I'm Scott Pohl.
When we return, General Motors will once again close plants and shred workers. Are employees here in Lansing safe?
Looking into the next years of the auto industry, I think, you know, people are being very, very conservative in some of their assumptions.
Also, we'll chat with NPR's Cokie Roberts.
There are a lot of good candidates. There are a lot of interesting people. And it's going to be fun to watch.
And later, a Great Lakes program allowing women to care for their infants while in prison.
We certainly can't control the fact that they come to prison, but we can definitely control what we do with them while they're here.
This is Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
School resource officer is many things: mentor, mediator, counselor, cop. The state of Michigan wants to make sure all SROs receive the same training. Techniques can be learned, but trust must be earned.
The feeling of those kids could be the same feeling that my child has, and I would want them to know that there's somebody that's out there willing to protect them.
I'm Kevin Lavery. Listen for that story Tuesday on Morning Edition on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
Bye, bye, Miss American Life. Don't
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. This week, General Motors announced plans to close three production plants and phase out models like the Impala and the Electric Volt. Here's how it was reported on the PBS NewsHour on Monday.
General Motors announced today it is slashing its workforce by as many as 14,000 employees, including a quarter of its executives, and shuttering several plants in North America. At least five passenger car models will be eliminated, resulting in shutdowns next year at three plants in Detroit, Northeast Ohio, and Ontario. Two other U.S. plants are on notice. This would be the company's biggest shakeup since it faced bankruptcy a decade ago.
The Lansing area's two GM plants were spared, but what might the future hold for local production? WKAR's Scott Pohl talks with Micheline Maynard via Skype. She is a veteran journalist and author whose subjects have included the Detroit carmakers.
The GM plant closings and layoffs that were announced this week left Lansing untouched. Lansing's two GM plants are the newest in the system, so it made me wonder if maybe that's why or if there might be more to it than that.
Right. Well, I think the GM plants in Lansing are safe for now because one of the things that protects them is they were built in this era of soft automation, where we use software in part to program what kinds of tasks are done on the factory floor. If you look at the other General Motors plants, even though they were modernized, even though they were updated, Lordstown, Oshawa, and the Detroit Poletown plant all predate the software era. They're hard automation plants. And so every time General Motors had to update them, they had to completely tear them apart. So I think the newness of the Lansing plants is probably going to keep them going for quite a while.
Do you think there's any possibility or likelihood that workers who are losing their jobs elsewhere will one day wind up in Lansing, sent here if they're willing to come to Lansing? Is there going to be any possibility of that?
Oh, yeah, there's already been discussion of that. Within the UAW, this is called transfer rights. But what's interesting is that transfer rights used to be much wider than they are now. There was a time when you could basically work at almost any General Motors plant anywhere, and if your plant closed, you could transfer to another factory. Now the General Motors empire has kind of contracted a little bit, and from what I understand, transfer rights were affected by that too. I think the main thing that affects transfer rights is seniority.
Lansing is really proud of building the Camaro. Do you think the Camaro specifically is pretty safe for the time being?
Boy, that's a really hard one to answer. I wish I knew the profit margins on the Camaro because I think that's what's going to determine whether things stick around. If the Camaro is doing well relative to its production costs and its development costs, then I think GM would probably try to keep it. I mean, I think as long as Ford has the Mustang that, General Motors would want to have the Camaro. But honestly, looking into the next years of the auto industry, I think, people are being very, very conservative in some of their assumptions.
What do you make of the pressure that President Trump is putting on GM?
I think some of it is personal, honestly. I think that the president is angry at Mary Barra, the CEO of General Motors, and I think he feels that she somehow double-crossed him, and I have no logical explanation for that, but the president does seem to view things in the prism of his personal relationships. The interesting thing is that Mary Barra stayed on the president's American Manufacturing Council until it was disbanded. You might remember that about 16 months ago, people were starting to leave the council for various reasons. So Elon Musk left because he was upset that the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Accords. And then there were other CEOs who were angry over statements affecting Charlottesville, Virginia. But Mary Barra was one of the final CEOs left when the council disbanded. However, the president focused very clearly on Ohio and Michigan in the 2016 election campaign. And I think he feels like these plant closings will hurt his chances in 2020.
One final question for you. As we record on Friday morning, we're learning of a new trade deal with Mexico and Canada. Have you had a chance to consider that yet and how GM might be impacted by that new deal?
Right. So it's, you know, it's NAFTA 2, essentially, as people are calling it. I think it's the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement. I read the initial agreement, and the restrictions on auto sales are fairly light. I mean, so one of the limits basically says that no more than 2 million units can be shipped from Canada to the United States. And they haven't been close to 2 million units for years. So that's not going to affect automakers very much. The other thing, though, to think about are the steel and aluminum tariffs. And those definitely are affecting the car makers. And those are things that the automakers would like to see removed. And apparently, the president's associates have said we have no intention of doing that because the president is convinced that they're working. So I would, if I was watching the situation, keep an eye on steel and aluminum to see if there's any movement there.
Journalist and author Micheline Maynard has written about the auto industry and GM specifically for many years. It's always great talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Scott.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Now to a story from around the Great Lakes Basin. An unusual program at the Ohio Reformatory for Women allows some mothers to keep their infants while serving time. Proponents say the bonding helps children develop in a healthy way. Paige Flager reports.
Alicia Floyd bounces her son Chance on her lap.
He's the fattest baby here.
He's 4 months old, and his chunky little legs stick out of his blue striped onesie. The room's cinder block walls are covered in paintings of Sesame Street characters. Baby dolls lie tucked into miniature beds on the windowsill. Outside, surrounding the Ohio Reformatory for Women, there's a tall chain-link fence topped with barbed wire.
I was actually a month before my due date when I got sentenced.
Floyd is part of the prison's Achieving Baby Care Success Program, or ABC. It lets women who are pregnant when they're incarcerated keep their babies with them.
This is my first child, like, so if I didn't have him, I'd probably melt down. I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to raise him. So, I mean, it's a blessing, honestly, to be here. It's a big blessing.
There are a lot of women like Floyd. Some estimate that 1 in 25 women entering prison or jail is pregnant. But ABC is the only program of its kind in Ohio and one of about 10 in the country. In the Midwest, Indiana and Illinois have similar programs. The reformatory's warden, Ronette Burks, says the nursery program is good for the babies and a learning experience for the moms.
You go to school and you learn how to do all these things, but who teaches you how to be a parent?
The idea is to give mothers a chance to do things like breastfeed and bond with their newborns. That improves a child's long-term health and well-being. Studies show that children who spent time with their mothers in a prison nursery had less anxiety and depression than children who were separated because of incarceration. At the reformatory, a large window lets officers outside keep watch over the ABC nursery. But Floyd says it also allows some inmates to look in.
That's where the people look in the window and stare at the babies and stuff like that. We don't know what their charges are. So that's really what I don't like. That's the only part I don't like.
Ora Yazel just joined the unit, which can handle about 24 moms. She points out the walls of the rooms where moms and babies sleep don't go all the way to the ceiling. She says it's hard enough to get her newborn son Jacob to sleep without the sounds of other babies crying too.
I just got my baby to go back to sleep. Please, please stop crying. Please don't wake him up with your crying.
A new nursery building under construction should address those concerns. It also will have a full kitchen and more space for ABC programming. That includes breastfeeding consultation, postpartum counseling, Head Start, and weekly appointments with a pediatrician. It will cost the state more than $2 million. Warden Burke says the program helps moms develop good habits and skills that they take with them. Women in ABC also have to get a job or take classes.
We have a mom over there in college. And so how wonderful is it that she has an opportunity to work on her college degree, raise her child in a healthy environment?
She sometimes hears from people who think these nurseries are rewarding bad behavior. Other critics have argued that women in trouble with the law are unfit for motherhood. Prison officials point out that not every mother can join the ABC program. Offenders can't have a violent crime conviction or a history of problems with child services. Moms in the program typically were convicted of theft, parole violations, or similar crimes.
We certainly can't control the fact that they come to prison, but we can definitely control what we do with them while they're here and do our part as public servants to ensure or to at least give people all the tools they need so they don't come back.
Prison leaders say of the more than 300 women who have been through the ABC program, about 50 have returned to prison. That's slightly lower than the overall recidivism rate for women inmates in Ohio. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Paige Flager.
For decades, NPR listeners have heard the political reporting and commentary of Cokie Roberts. Earlier this week, she was the guest speaker at the Governor Jim Blanchard Public Service Forum at MSU. Cokie spent a few minutes with WKAR's Scott Pohl before the event to share some political insights.
Cokie Roberts, this is not the first time we've met. Back in 1992, Michigan State University hosted one of the Clinton-Bush-Perot presidential debates, and you were here for that debate. You came to WKAR the next morning to talk on Morning Edition, and you even indulged me in a short interview for our local listeners that morning. And what I most remember about that morning is how terribly sick you were, and yet you sounded great on the air. You had a bad cold, but every time the microphone was on, you sounded great. So welcome back to East Lansing.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back. And that was quite a night. I was remembering it as I was approaching this trip and thinking about that quite remarkable debate. It was cold here, as I recall, even though it was only October. So that's probably why I wasn't feeling so well.
People are hearing you these days on the Morning Edition Ask Cokie segment. So I wanted to ask you what you like about that. And do you get to be involved in picking the topic of the week?
Oh, I'm very involved. I generally do pick the topic. But it's fun to do. It's a little bit hokey, but people love it. And I get to tell stories, and I particularly like the opportunity to give the history of something. You know, I write history books, and to be able to tell people what the history of any part of our government is something that they find fascinating.
So now I get to ask Cokie, to what extent would you say Michigan politics is on your radar?
Oh, very much so. Michigan is a terribly important state. We always are aware of things going on here. Unfortunately, right now, we're aware because of the GM announcement. But the fact that a Democrat took the state in the governor's mansion is something that was very much on the top of the political radar screen.
We've all been analyzing the 2018 election results, but there's always something that we're missing. What story do you think maybe has been undercovered from this election?
I think that one of the things that people are unaware of is when they talk about the suburban vote, how much of the suburban vote is a minority vote. People tend to think of the suburbs as white. And in fact, white people in the suburbs voted Republican, both men and women. But the suburbs went pretty evenly to the two parties, and that's because there is a sizable now minority population in the suburbs.
Names are already starting to emerge as possible presidential candidates in 2020. I wanted to ask you if you have any thoughts at this very early stage. Maybe names we're not hearing yet, maybe even Republicans who might challenge President Trump.
Well, Republicans are talking about it. John Kasich is saying he thinks about it every day. And he talks about it quite honestly in the sense of saying, I don't know whether I'd be running to win or running to make a statement. Now, we know that if somebody does run, that it very much damages the president. When a president has a primary challenge, he often loses. Think Pat Buchanan against George Bush, Ted Kennedy against Jimmy Carter, Eugene McCarthy basically knocking Lyndon Johnson out. It's very hard for a president to sustain the challenge of a primary. So that's something that it would seem to me that the anti-Trump Republicans should be thinking about. On the Democratic side, it's anybody's guess. You know, we're way too far out, and the party is very much figuring out where its soul is at the moment. And so I think that there are a lot of good candidates, there are a lot of interesting people, and it's going to be fun to watch.
NPR's Cokie Roberts. Again, welcome back to East Lansing. Thank you.
So nice to be with you, Scott.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
Up next, a way you can help seniors in need in the Capital Region this holiday season.
The typical senior recipient is crying when the delivery drivers get there because they know this is the one time of year that they're going to get a visit.
Plus, our Serving Up Science team tries ready-to-make meal kits. Also, Michigan State basketball.
You gotta check her out. She's so in control. She's just a lightning bolt of energy.
Al Martin tells us which men's and women's players to keep your eye on. And later, Songs of the Season from MSU's College of Music. You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR. We often think of children during the season of giving, but one event makes sure that seniors in the Capital Region are not forgotten. Joining us now is Tracy Ruiz, former Lansing Police Lieutenant and owner of Ruiz Consultants. She coordinates the Tri-County Triad. Welcome to WKAR.
Thank you, Reginald. Nice here to be with you.
So tell us about the Tri-County Triad. How does that help seniors?
Yes, a Tri-County Triad focuses on senior safety. So Triad is a nationally recognized program. It is not an acronym. And the national symbol is a triangle. So it's law enforcement, community members, and seniors working together for senior safety. Here in Tri-County Triad, in our area, what we do is we've included our firefighters. So that has been a great addition. They are our host for our annual No Senior Without Christmas, which we're very excited about, helping 350 indigent homebound elders through the holiday season. We've been doing it since 2000. And what's pretty awesome about it is we started with 20 Meyer paper bags, approximately, with a couple of crocheted items that our senior citizens made. And in 2009, we were able to fundraise through the years. And in 2009, we jumped to 200 boxes. In 2010, we jumped to 300. And the need continues to grow. So we have been running 350 boxes last year and this year.
What are the things that people need?
Seniors, our most needed items are shampoo, conditioner, body wash. Body wash is really helpful instead of bars of soap because it's not slippery in their hands. Dish soap, laundry soap is a big deal. Bounce sheets. Hand sanitizing wipes are a great addition because they only need to wipe down a surface and throw them away. It's nothing that they need, a cloth that they need to wash. They also are in need of food items. Oats are a great meal for them, a nutritious meal where they can have instant oats that heat up quickly, and they only take water to be able to provide them some hot, nutritious meal. We provide them canned goods as well. They often ask for canned soup, Dinty Moore beef soup, also corn, you know, all kinds of vegetable items.
So tell us about the event where everything's kind of put together, and then how does that get to the seniors?
So No Senior Without Christmas is happening this year on Thursday, December 6th at Lansing Fire Station. We gather around, and Lansing Fire Station has been our great host annually, and we have about 160 volunteers that will show. It's word of mouth. We really don't have an email list that goes out. Literally, people are knocking on our doors or calling us to find out when this event is going to happen each year. It is always the first week of December, and it's one of the days during the week. We don't have a set day during the week. So on that day, we'll get together. We'll start bright and early at 7 a.m. We'll start unloading these trailers and pods. We have some donations that are put in pods. And we'll set up and organize tables, and it'll be like an assembly line or a factory line, if you will, of tables down the row. People will pick up a box that are graciously donated by two men in a truck, and we'll pick up a box and go down the line and put one item of each product as we go down that line. It'll be boxed up, and then volunteers will load those boxes into our patrol cars and fire trucks for delivery. And then our uniformed officers or uniformed firefighters will then go out and deliver those boxes personally to each senior, which is 350 on our list in the Tri-County area. And so that senior has been called ahead of time, or law enforcement has knocked on the door to make sure they're still living there and that they're going to be home on that day of delivery, so they know it's safe to open that door if they can, or if there's special instructions where they're disabled and they can't open their own door, they'll give instructions to us on how we can access that place so we can get in and provide a visit. So it's a one day during the year that our law enforcement and firefighters get so excited about, because normally they're running on 911 calls to these homes and they don't get to visit in the middle of a crisis. And this is truly the one day during the year that these seniors are getting a gift, a give back to them, if you will, and a visit from a uniformed officer or a uniformed firefighter.
What does it mean to them to be able to deliver some good news?
It means the world to these seniors. There are tears of joy. On average, the typical senior recipient is crying when the delivery drivers get there because they know this is the one time a year that they're going to get a visit. We've had people in the past that's been 7 years without a gift, a visit from someone. There are people that are, like I said, aging in place. They're truly trying to remain living in their own home, so they won't ask people for things. They won't say anything that there's something wrong because they truly want to remain living independently. So that once a year, they know they can rely upon that visit from a firefighter or a police officer, and they know it's safe to open the door, and they also know that they're getting something, receiving something, as opposed to that scam on the phone or the call that might come in to say, hey, we need you to give to the local fire charity or police charity, which ends up not being the case.
How many other groups cater to seniors in this way here in the Lansing area?
Great question. That's a really great question. We are one of the few free services that are provided in this Tri-County area, Tri-County Triad, that is. RSVP, which is Retired Senior Volunteer Program, also provides some services to seniors in our area for free as well. But that's about all you're going to get in this area. Most of the other services are paid services where, of course, as you know, every year people are giving during December and they want to donate to certain charities. And we have so many great people in our community that are willing to give, and they give to children's programs and homeless programs. But oftentimes our elders are the forgotten population.
Last question, how do people get involved and where do they contact you?
So Tri-County Triad has a website. We also have a Facebook, so they can find us on TRI-County, TRIAD, all capital letters. On the website, it would be www.tricountytriad.org. If anybody has questions, they can email us on the website or they can call 517-483-6680. And if they know of any seniors in need, please have them get a hold of us because we'd like to help them throughout the year and make sure that our community is involved in helping these elders who have helped us so much along throughout our careers and lives.
Well, thank you, Tracy. And we will have all that information on WKAR.org. We've been talking with Tracy Ruiz, former Lansing Police Lieutenant and owner of Ruiz Consultants, about the Tri-County Triad.
Thank you, Reginald.
Food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science. For this week's show, we tried a little experiment.
Cheryl and I both have busy schedules, young children, and not a lot of time.
But we still want to make sure we provide a healthy, balanced diet for our families.
And that's why we were intrigued by meal kits. They advertise to my social media accounts constantly, and they seem like an interesting way to try new foods without too much prep and seem like a good way to mix up the menu at home.
There are a lot of options, too. HelloFresh, Blue Apron, Plated.
And it seems like everyone I know has tried them.
Everyone but us.
Until now.
On today's episode, we're going to break down meal kits, the pros and cons of meals delivered in a box to your house every week.
We ordered meal kits from Blue Apron. Full disclosure, Blue Apron did not sponsor us in any way, and we're just using the service as one example of several available on the market to try. We both received recipes and ingredients to prepare two meals for two in a week, all in the name of science.
Or at least in the name of serving up science. So let's start with delivery. Carell, what were your impressions of the box of perfectly portioned ingredients as it arrived?
Well, for how noticeable the box is in the company's branding, I was surprised by its size. It wasn't ridiculously large or anything, just bigger than what I'm used to. Upon opening the box, though, I was pretty surprised about how well packaged the contents are. Keep in mind these products are trying to be kept fresh without full knowledge of when they'll be opened by the customer, so things like ice packs are not surprising to find.
I agree. The box itself isn't so big, but it does seem like a lot to unpack. On one hand, meal delivery services actually do encourage people to conserve food. You cook what you get, and you don't have much waste at the end. We've explored our enormous food waste problem on previous episodes of Serving Up Science. In the U.S., we waste nearly half of the food we produce, so limiting food waste is certainly a positive.
In fact, Blue Apron signed onto the U.S. Food Loss and Waste 2030 Champions Pledge from the Environmental Protection Agency, which aims to cut down waste by 50% by 2030.
Glad to hear it.
But then there's the packaging.
Definitely the first thing we both noticed.
Single-serving green onions wrapped in plastic, a capful of vinegar in its own plastic bottle. Excess packaging puts a damper on the experience from an environmental perspective.
And don't forget those plastic-covered freezer packs intended to keep the food fresh. Blue Apron piles up more than 190,000 tons in freezer pack waste every year, according to Mother Jones.
And yet they make it clear that the freezer packs are recyclable, but cleaning and recycling them isn't always easy, so I expect a lot of their clients aren't doing it.
And many recycling services also don't want to take plastic bags.
So when it comes to the packaging, we're not very impressed.
Although Blue Apron has launched a returns program, so you can put all the packaging from a few shipments back into one of its boxes, print a label, and mail it back for them to recycle.
So at least they've thought about it.
But something else that bothers me a bit is all of that travel to our homes, which also creates excess carbon emissions.
Something most of us don't think about too much.
But a real problem. However, Blue Apron is trying to address the extra transportation by making their meal kits available in grocery stores. Reportedly, they also obtain their food from family farms that use regenerative practices.
And they also advertise that they won't sell meat raised with hormones or antibiotics.
I want to interject with a side note here. Hormones and antibiotics in agriculture are topics we'll tackle later on Serving Up Science.
And their fish has to meet the standards of the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch.
As a marine biologist and former fisheries scientist, that's a huge positive for me.
Me too, but I'm still hung up on the packaging. I mean, yeah, it's recyclable, but it's also likely going to end up as a lot of waste for most households.
I'm sure you're right.
Regardless, the meal kit industry is booming, and it's been predicted to gross $10 billion in annual sales by 2020.
Which is comparable to pizza delivery, which currently accounts for $10 billion a year. Although I suspect big pizza will still be just fine regardless, because meal kits are not exactly a competitor.
Okay, so we've covered the box and contents. What was your cooking experience like?
I have to say, it was really good. We tried two meals, a classic seared steak and mashed potatoes with roasted Brussels sprouts, and sweet and spicy barramundi. Notably, it was sustainably caught. The recipes were ready in about the estimated time of a half hour, and we really enjoyed them. Our boys even ate the fish, which is always a gamble.
I can relate to that.
But I feel like we get stuck in a bit of a rut most weeks. We rotate through the same five or six dishes that are quick, easy, and generally eaten by all of us. Tacos, pastas, salads, pretty quick and simple dishes we like.
And the meal kits were different.
I was trying seasonings and spices I'm not familiar with and looked forward to something different. Plus, I picked up some new techniques for searing and roasting in the process.
So, would you try it again?
I'm getting another box this afternoon. And what about you?
Well, I think I'll stick with regular old grocery shopping. While the novelty of it was pretty fun, I found myself hung up by the sometimes vague directions they give you. And then there's the big deal breaker for me, which is the lack of leftovers. Again, keep in mind, when they say perfectly portioned, they mean it. With a two-year-old kid in the house, we always cook with the idea of eating the leftovers for lunch the next day. Maybe if the option to choose the size of your portions gets added, I'll be ready to revisit the idea.
And in the meantime, with the winter weather coming, you can try your slow cooker. You've been listening to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and planet.
This series is produced in association with Food at MSU. I'm Carell Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And this is WKAR.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR. Let's talk about Michigan State University basketball, and I'm joined now by current sports host Al Martin. Welcome.
How you doing, Rich?
I'm great. It seems both the men and women are off to good starts, so let's start with the women. They had a good week.
They did. You know, they are coming off a win over Virginia at the Breslin Center, a midweek game,
at home. Reg, I mean, this was a wire-to-wire win for MSU. They looked so poised and so confident. And for me, what really stood out were not only the play of a freshman like Tori Osmond and also Nia Clouden, who is a pleasure to watch. If you have not, Spartan fans out there, if you have not seen this freshman Nia Clouden play, you got to check her out. She's so in control. She's just a lightning bolt of energy watching her ball out. But not only, you know, freshmen like Nia Clouden and Tori Osmond, but also a player who I really think is taking the reins as the leader and the playmaker on this team, and that's Taryn McCutcheon, who was brilliant as well, and her jump shot is really improving. So just a total blowout victory for the Spartans, and they go into the weekend now playing host to Texas Southern this Sunday.
We're talking with current sports host Al Martin about MSU basketball. Let's switch over to the men. They seem to be going along smoothly, but then hit a road bump.
They certainly did, Reg. I think Spartan fans are still, you know, licking their wounds from what we saw earlier this week against Louisville. Because, you know, Reg, that was a game that, you know, you're playing an unranked Louisville team. Louisville, many predicting, like myself coming into this year, that they would not have the greatest season. They got some talent, but they're unranked. You're Michigan State. You are a top 15 program. You got to get that win. First true road test for Michigan State. Anybody knows who, you know, if you watch a game on television and you see the Louisville fans, I mean, that is one of the toughest road environments that you can play in all of college basketball. And this was the first true road test for Michigan State. And, you know, that loss to Louisville just really leaves a bad taste in your mouth, because you know that Michigan State is clearly the more talented team. So Michigan State has to get back on track and put the wheels back on track against Rutgers come this weekend.
So a year ago, it was all about Miles Bridges. So this season, who are you keeping your eye on?
Three juniors, Reg, without a doubt. I mean, Cassius Winston, this team will go as far as Cassius Winston takes them. Just because he does so much for this team. He is the primarily ball handler. He's the one, you know, dishing out assists. He is your go-to scorer and a guy who can create his own shot. But also, I want to bring up the two other juniors in Joshua Langford and Nick Ward as well, because Nick Ward was a guy who did dip his toe in the NBA draft lottery. He got feedback. You know, he wasn't going to be a top, you know, first or second round pick. He wasn't going to get picked. So he got that feedback and came back slimmer, faster, stronger. But in my estimation, he's underperformed so far this year. He's got to play better than what he has, because I believe that he's disappeared even in the Las Vegas Invitational Championship game and what we saw against Louisville. Nick Ward was nowhere to be found. But also Josh Langford, too, because he is a guy who is taking his game to a new level, I think, this year, and he's confident. And that is something that we haven't seen from Josh yet. I mean, he's a guy now who says, look, give me the basketball. If you guys can't score, I am going to find a way to score. And he's showing a versatility to his game that we haven't seen before. It's not just mid-range now. He's also taking the ball to the basket. So, number one, Cassius Winston. Two, Nick Ward. Maybe 2A, Nick Ward. 2B, Josh Langford. Depending on the night, Reg.
Thank you, current sports host Al Martin, for joining us. And you can hear him weekdays at 1 p.m. on FM 105.1 WKAR News Talk.
Thank you, Reg.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. Next Saturday, December 8th, the MSU College of Music presents the Holiday Concert, Peace, Joy, and Songs of the Season. Dr. David Rail conducts vocal ensembles from MSU and the MSU Symphony at East Lansing's St. Thomas Aquinas Church at 8 p.m. WKAR station manager Peter Worf speaks with Dr. Rail about the program, which includes music by Handel, Rafe Vaughan Williams, and Gustav Holst.
Vaughan Williams and Gustav Holst, who was his contemporary in early 20th century England, was a big collector of folk songs, folk carols. And in fact, he also contributed to the Episcopal hymnal, which came out in the first decade of the 20th century. So he was very interested in hymnody. He was very interested in hymnody that was somehow tied to or attached to or came out of the tradition of English folk music. So his Fantasia on Christmas Carols uses a variety of carols that he had collected or knew about, and he sort of weaves them together into a very interesting mix. Some of them will be familiar to people, some will not be.
And then Holst does a similar thing with the orchestra.
Holst essentially does the same thing, right, with a piece called Christmas Day. The carols that he uses are not always tied to the folk tradition, but they're from various English British hymnals from the late 19th, early 20th century. He uses, for example, the First Noel. An old French tune that people will recognize. A couple of other tunes that people will recognize.
God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Sure.
Except which we've changed to God Rest Ye Merry Gentle Folk. Good Christian friends rejoice.
Yes, as it should be.
Yeah. So trying to remove the gendered language. But both of those pieces have carols that people will recognize, and they're both arranged, both composers arranged them in, I think, a very interesting and attractive way.
Dr. David Rail conducts the holiday concert at St. Thomas Church in East Lansing this year. That's December 8th.
December 8th, Saturday.
David, thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And with that beautiful music, we will say goodbye. For the WKAR News Team, I'm Reginald Hardwick. Thank you for joining us for Current State.
Oh, Come and take us.